Why does Revelation 17's woman, clothed in scarlet and purple and seated on the eighth king, perplex interpreters so much? In this preview, I show how a seventh context framework paired with precise textual analysis brings her identity, posture, and authority into view. By applying a novel hermeneutical framework, puzzling motives such as the seven mountains, the emergence of the eighth king, and the one-hour prophecy resolve in a single sweep. You leave with your own aha moment and a ready-to-use template. I'm Ingrid Homoot, biologist turned theologian from the Netherlands, and participating in the Revelation 17 Prophecy Conference. Today I'll show you what happens when science meets scripture. I took courage for this endeavor from the words of Ellen White talking about the 1888 debate. I quote, "If every idea we have entertained in doctrines is truth, will not the truth bear to be investigated? Will it totter and fall if criticized? If so, let it fall. The sooner, the better. The spirit that would close the door to investigation of points of truth in a Christ-like manner is not the spirit from above." Unquote. This challenge, truth can withstand scrutiny, underpins the Adventist commitment to testing prophecy against unfolding history. Seventh-day Adventist attitude to engage in continuous evaluation of prevailing prophetic interpretations is indeed remarkable. It shows courage in testing cherished beliefs against new insights. This spirit of inquiry ensures that the truth remains vibrant, robust, and always open to Christ-like scrutiny, because truths can afford to be fair. Revelation does not stand alone. It is embedded within the broader narrative of Revelation's midsection, the chapters 12 to 18. In these chapters, the cosmic conflict of the great controversy between Christ and Satan unfolds. In 2020, when I began to study this part of Revelation intensively, I designed a preliminary seven context interpretive model to capture the hermeneutical framework of Revelation's vision. Prophetic context, singular vision, time frame, historical, political, ecclesiastical, and geographical context form interlocking building blocks of a conceptual house. This framework enables a replicable, coherent, and consistent reading across Revelation. I first applied these contexts to 16 key images that form the symbolic backbone of the Great Controversy theme. They are discussed on the pages 54 until 86 of my paper. Additionally, textual analysis, tracing the meaning of Greek wording and their Old Testament, New Testament echoes, unpacking key lexical nuances, and mapping syntactical structures enriches each contextual block. Together, these four interpretive layers form a strong hermeneutical model to approach each passage with scientific rigor. I mainly use the first four contexts for analyzing Revelation 17. Prophetic context spotlights fulfillment. If we miss that Revelation is the continuation of Daniel, we miss a lot. Singular vision confirms narrative unity, and there are many markers telling us that the book has one narrative plot told in scenes. Time frame clarifies sequence. Jesus informs us that Revelation starts at Pentecost. The historical context anchors symbols in real events of Roman history. Those four and the analysis of text, lexis, and syntax were enough to get a coherent interpretation of Revelation 17. Furthermore, they brought a few critical Greek terms to the foreground. Those Greek terms shape Revelation 17's interpretation. Katimena epiterion sitson beast, ore mountains, basileis eptaesin seven kings are, oligon little, epton epta auto seven, and mian horan unity season. Each of these key Greek terms carry significant symbolic and qualitative force that shape Revelation's interpretation tremendously. In the next four slides, two case studies will demonstrate the methodology in action. The first case study is the Ketemene Epiterion phrase in Revelation 17, verse 3. What does the verse Ketemene tell us? In the text layer, we read Ketemene Epiterion as is seated or sitting upon beast. Lexically, Ketemene comes from the deponent verb katemai, literally to sit or to be seated. It's built from kata down and aimai to sit firmly and unmovably. It carries the sense of she sits. The second part of the phrase, epiterion, literally means upon beast, with the preposition plus accusative case lexically marking location. Syntactically, the time, case, and voice in the feminine nominative singular of katemene agrees with the woman. Like all Greek deponents, it expresses active meaning even in a passive form. So the term depicts a stationary posture rather than motion. So is she riding or is she sitting? That's an important question. Note that there are no verbs suggesting stepping on to ride, such as epibino, to go upon, to mount, to step onto, or epipepho, to ride a horse. The spatial nuance specifies that the woman sits without implying control over the beast. And the textual analysis strengthens the theological, historical, and even ecclesiastical and political contexts. It brings in the nuance of the church's passive stance once she had seated herself, while Roman authority actively sustained and established her ecclesiastical authority. We are talking about the 325 AD Nicene Council, positioning Catholicism over Arianism here, leading to codifying Catholicism in 533 and establishing it in 538. This passive posture underscores the Church's reliance on Roman support. The Church was not an independent entity, it was a department of the state. The arrangement was mutually beneficial. Roman emperors protected ecclesiastical authority, while the popes mediated for their souls. The popes needed imperial approval for their position until 751. So answering the question, is she writing? We can confirm that there is no Greek basis whatsoever for translating or suggesting Ketemene Epiterion to mean riding the beast. The text contradicts that assumption. The term emphasizes passive posture of enabling ecclesiastical authority while relying on political support. The next case study, the second case study, is the phrase ekton hepta in Revelation 17, verse 11. Many Bible versions say one of the seven. Is that accurate? Lexical analysis reveals that the preposition ek means out of or from, signaling an emergent eighth king. So the answer is no. Out of seven signals emergence and not membership. The syntactical partitive genitive echoes Daniel 7:8, little horn, arising between or among, in Hebrew there's the word ben, between or among the ten horns, marking origin and emergence. Again, the textual nuance strengthens the historical timeline of seven Roman phases, culminating in the eighth king, bringing both textual precision and historical clarity. Notice how Revelation 17:11's phrase ekton hepta about the eighth basileion corresponds to Roman phases 1 to 7, with stage H emerging out of the seven. The preposition ek indicates a new ruler emerging out of or from the same lineage as the seven. And note also that the text does not say the seventh. The angel emphasizes that there will be eight. This means that if we translate that the eight is one of the seven or the seventh, the end score in both instances is seven. Not eight. The beast embodies historical continuity and identifies papal Rome as an emergent eighth, not merely the seventh. The eighth king is the end stage monarchy of Roman power, Daniel's fourth beast. The three remaining contexts further enrich the interpretation. The political is that of Imperial Rome, followed by the Holy Roman Empire's political influence over the many peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. The ecclesiastical context is that of enabled doctrinal coercion. The geographical scope is on two continents, Euroasia and America. Revelation 17's mystery is solved when we understand that the apostasy began as religious authority enthroned on political power, echoing Revelation 13, verse 2. That it progressed as ecclesiastical authority, augmenting political authority and projecting a process which will culminate in an upcoming global alliance against Christ and his chosen. On August 2024 call for papers had me saying to myself, I can say something about that. Well, it has been an incredible journey, spurred by much prayer, midnight insights and scribbles, Greek lexicon dyes, and a year of intense research, designing charts and tables that produced a 51,000 plus words manuscript, visualizing the chronology of the eight kings, the flowing plot of Revelation's vision, the researching the fiery red Draco standard of Roman cavalry. All these charts and tables and maps are included in the paper. This preview video obviously can only scratch the surface. Preparing for this conference has been awesome, and it is still work in progress and in an incredible ongoing journey of acknowledging that indeed truth can afford to be fair. I promise you my research template, here it is. But ask the researcher to answer key questions for each exegetical layer. Print screeners and ask Copilot or ChatGPT to turn the picture into a fill-in form. I think it's also on the research page of the conference website. The working instructions are simply two. For each context, reflect on the key questions and write concise notes based on research. After filling out, compare across context and textual analysis to see how they interlock into your own overall interpretation. Here's how it works for Revelation 17, verse 3. The prophetic question asks, which New Testament, Old Testament, Daniel echo informs the Scarlet Woman on the beast? In Daniel 7:7-8, we see that Daniel hints that Earth's final power would differ from the previous ones. He projected a beast with 10 horns on its head and an emerging 11 coming up between or among the 10. And next he saw 3 horns being uprooted while the little one was growing. The historical context is that of an era of ongoing weakening of the Western Roman Empire. It shows a church, a woman, being upheld by Roman polity, a beast, for more than 4 centuries, from 325 to 751, before it acquired its own political power. It shows the continuation of legacy of the 7 pagan Roman stages and the evolution from the weak and insignificant 7th, the Exarchate of Ravenna, into the peculiar 8th stage of papal Roman power. This 8th then goes through phases of being, not being, and restoration before perdition halts its path. The last row, the textual analysis affirms that she sits firmly on an enabled throne. She is not riding, she is not steering. Try the template for yourself and tell me if it works for you. I'm also curious if it works beyond passages of Daniel and Revelation. And now, of course, we would not be Adventists if there were no remaining questions to be answered. This is work in progress. The conference is work in progress. Textual criticism specialists are invited to help explore variant manuscript readings in depth. Anyone intrigued in EU politics can review Appendix 4, the pages 173 to 178, for the assumption that shaping modern Europe may have been directed by papal subtleties. I think this topic, European eschatology, deserves an in-depth Adventist examination. I'm Ingrid Holmes. Please see the conference program online. There will be a more in-depth plenary presentation of my findings with lively discussion and Q&A, I think on Thursday afternoon, October 16th. Thank you for listening.